Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can robots do for you? And what will they do as scientists refine the technologies that allow them to move, respond, and process information more like human beings? David Hansen is a robotics designer and researcher. His mission is to realize friendly, super intelligent machines that perceive and respond to humans in ways that were the stuff of science fiction just a decade or two ago. Hansen's robots can read facial expressions, recognize and respond to human speech, and even demonstrate a range of emotions on faces covered with a groundbreaking synthetic skin called Frubber. His company, Hansen Robotics, is headquartered in Richardson and serves clients around the world. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
So you try to create machines that behave like living creatures. What can they do?
Well, at this time, the robots can express themselves in a very human-like way with expressions that are very warm, thanks to a combination of artistry and technology. And in order to achieve these kinds of expressions, we had to sort of push the technology forward to facilitate the artistry, if you will. Additionally, the robots can see faces, recognize faces, learn your name, understand your speech, remember what you've said versus another person so that it can recall your conversation. They can have a fairly natural, free-flowing conversation with you about a wide variety of subjects. A lot of this is facilitated by real artificial intelligence, however, real in the sense of today's artificial intelligence, which is not smart to the level of a human being. So in that sense, it's more like sort of a combination of theater and real artificial intelligence, but it's getting smarter all the time.
Do your robots have the ability to learn based on their environments and the things that they're exposed to?
Yes. So machine learning has come quite a ways over the last few years. We, at this time, are learning mostly what people's faces look like and little bits of information about who a person is through the course of the conversation. So our robots are really focused on this human-robot interaction. But other forms of machine learning include the ability to learn a space and navigate autonomously through a space, you know, urban or office space or home environment. Robots have really come a long way in the last 10 years, and one of the major tasks remaining is integrating all of these different developments into a total synthetic intelligent being.
Has there been anything similar to a twin study done with robots where you take two identical machines and sort of put them in separate environments and then compare them?
Oh, that's a focus of robotics research all around the world, trying to establish performance metrics to see how well robots perform. Some of the better funded studies include autonomous navigation through urban environments in these DARPA Grand Challenge competitions or through the desert, autonomously driving from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. You have unmanned aerial vehicles that are put through all kinds of paces to find out how well they're performing. There is a whole sector of robotics called human-robot interaction that's focused on establishing performance metrics for how robots interact with people and how people perceive the robots. So it's a multidisciplinary affair involving neuroscience, cognitive science, electrical engineering, software development. In that sense, it's really like a renaissance.
We have a clip here of the robot Joey Chaos. And before we play it, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about him.
Sure. When we're developing robots, I sort of call in my background as an artist. I like the idea that robots would have some attitude. So we wanted to sort of push this to a kind of extreme with a sort of, mentally addled, if you will, punk rocker character. And this was developed in collaboration with Professor Thomas Riccio from the University of Texas at Dallas.
So my son always said that you shouldn't make robots look human because it would be too weird. But I think that's exactly why we should make robots look human. Because it makes us think about those boundaries that define what is human. Okay, so like modern neuroscience shows that we process human faces and a human social identity with the same part of the brain, man, the part of the brain they call the fusiform face area, or FFA. So here's where it gets interesting. We associate, I mean like neurally, hardwired, we associate people's face with human identity. And a totally different part of the brain, the temporal region, processes objects. So when an object, like a robot, shows a face like a person, you get this category mismatch. And this is really interesting. I mean, interesting both artistically and scientifically. So by building robots, we can force this perceptual category mismatch and literally challenge what we know, what we presume about human identity. It's the weirdest thing. Anyhow, I guess that's where I fit in. I mean, I am a living identity crisis.
So at this point in 2010, Joey Chaos's opinions are David Hansen's opinions. Is that right?
It's a combination of my opinions and the opinions of other writers on our team of writers. And what's kind of interesting is in those robots where we allow the robot to semantically mush ideas together through this process called latent semantic analysis that relates ideas to one another, and then it just sticks them together.
So you didn't write a script, essentially, that's exactly the text that we just heard, that the robot is synthesizing the ideas that are contained there.
So this, what you just heard, was written. So it was written by me and by Thomas Riccio. Other robots, like the Philip K. Dick robot, we did an android portrait of this science fiction writer named Philip K. Dick, who wrote about androids.
The Blade Runner guy.
That particular android used the writings, like the journals, the diaries, thousands of pages of the diaries, interviews, letters, basically the voice of Philip K. Dick as the mind of Philip K. Dick. So, but it also had a layer that would chop up all those ideas, semantically analyze them through this latent semantic analysis process, and then glue them together as new ideas in response to what people were saying. And also based on patterns of ideas that Philip K. Dick had generated. So in other words, there was kind of an idea generator thrown in. Now, it works in this incredible free form, free association fashion. But to make ideas that are more coherent, we either use human authors or we are building these we're relying on these more elaborate semantic models, ontologies, which we're harvesting from the latest artificial intelligence research, and we're sort of pushing forward with our new architecture. But with Joey Chaos, with some of our other robots, you're hearing the work of human authors mostly.
Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate a time within your working life when robots will be able to synthesize their own ideas and, as it were, form their own opinion?
Yeah. I mean, we're able to put together some pretty interesting, entertaining robots that seem alive and aware. But for them to reach their potential, they need to be really aware, truly understanding. And so we've got tools for doing rudimentary understanding, and those tools are getting better all the time. I think definitely within our lifetime, we're going to see these robots. I say I think because that's my opinion about this. There's some debate over whether robots will achieve human-level intelligence or greater than human-level intelligence. It's not proven one way or the other yet, but it's reasonable to assume that it's possible. And so I've set the objective through a nonprofit organization that I founded called the Apollo Mind Initiative that we would achieve greater than human levels of creative genius in machines by the year 2019. So that's what we're striving towards, and we're striving towards it through two phases. One is an integration phase where we're integrating all of this very powerful artificial intelligence technology, like semantic computing, genetic algorithms, and probabilistic robotics, where a robot makes probabilistic models of the world, bringing all these things together. And then doing some new architecture to integrate it into something that's very close to what we could call consciousness. So it's a neurally inspired or cognitively inspired model of consciousness that's just all machine algorithms. It's just all running on the computer. And then testing it to see if it works through course through the course of interaction with people, and then through the generation of new ideas. You know, we have to establish tests to determine whether the machine actually passes, you know, our best idea of what creative genius is for people. And IQ tests aren't necessarily the right tests, because you can engineer a machine to pass IQ tests pretty easily. But if it starts generating new groundbreaking physics theories, if it starts to generate art that is just, you know, soul-touching and really deeply moving to people. If it starts to show this sort of ability to navigate creatively, autonomously, and adaptively through the world, then I think we can start to say that we've achieved our objective of greater than human level intelligence in machines.
You know, it's interesting that, you made this Philip K. Dick robot, and I know you're a huge fan of his work, because there was a lot of ambivalence in his work about the idea that, we could create robots that were as intelligent as we were and had similar capabilities, maybe even higher capabilities.
That's right. Yeah. And even more than whether we could, he was ambivalent about whether such machines would be good or evil. And he defined humanity as not being like made of flesh and blood, but being compassionate, the capacity for compassion. So when I was a child and a science fiction fan, I really took this to heart, that we needed to evolve, not as a species necessarily, but as a civilization. And so if you look at his works, two works that stand in contrast, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep showed an example of a vision of robots that absolutely lacked compassion entirely. They were just psychotic and very dangerous. Versus a novel entitled We Can Build You, where the robots are more compassionate than people. They're warm. They care. The most compassionate character in the book is an Abraham Lincoln robot. I mean, far more than any of the human characters. And so in his lecture, The Android and the Human, Philip K. Dick defined humanity, what is human, as the capacity for compassion. So if we can elevate our machines to be truly empathetic and compassionate, it requires a deep understanding. It also requires an understanding and an outlook for the greatest common good of civilization, machines, life on the planet, and incredible creative capability. The inventive capability of inventing a new future spontaneously of its own accord. Let's face it, though, machine intelligence is alien. It's not like humans. Even if it's inspired by human intelligence, it's still kind of alien. And so it has to earn our trust.
Hang on 1 second. My guest is David Hansen. He's a robotics designer and the founder of Hansen Robotics, headquartered in Richardson, Texas. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Robotics designer and researcher David Hansen is with us. His company is called Hansen Robotics. You can find them online along with YouTube clips of some of the robots at work at hansenrobotics.com. If you want to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Do you find it useful or not useful to try to put your finger on the line between where the science ends and the art begins, or is there no line?
I believe that there is a line, but it's kind of a fractal. It's hard to say because intuition of the artist for how robots can be perceived is a set of clues for how the human mind cognitively is processing faces, facial expressions, social engagement in general. So that intuition about how characters can be designed and how they may interact is the basis for our software engineering and the hardware engineering as well. That drives the entire process. But it's not just pure intuition. There's something there. We just, intuitively or informally, I should say, understand social engagement. We show facial expressions to each other all the time. We're able to form words in a musical way. And we do it in our conversations as we're doing the most trivial things through the course of our days. Well, an artist takes that kind of thing, the motives that drive that sort of expression and the nuances of the expressions themselves, and puts them into Pixar films or into a great novel or a painting. Okay, and so in that sense, using software and robotics hardware as an artistic medium just allows us to externalize some of these kinds of social engagement behaviors and processes with more detail than other media might allow. Through the course of my graduate studies, my perspective was that we could test these kinds of perceptions of the artist in cognitive science experiments. Performed a few cognitive science experiments testing the uncanny valley principle, which is that human-like robots are inherently creepy. The more realistic you make them, the creepier they get. Had some very interesting results that were published in the proceedings of the International Journal of Cognitive Science. Then we continue to push this with our collaborators at the Machine Perception Laboratory at UCSD and in autism therapy studies in Messina, Italy, and Pisa, Italy, testing both neurotypical and autistic individuals in how they perceive robots and also how expressions can be spontaneously generated and perceived by people interacting with the robots.
And what was the difference for autistic people as opposed who don't typically read facial expressions very accurately as opposed to people who were neurotypical?
So the autism therapy studies so far haven't involved a neurotypical control group. So the neurotypical studies were separate. Mm-hmm. The neurotypical individuals spanned a wide range of population from 18 to 57 years old. They reacted to the robots in a way that you might expect. Some of them were creeped out. They were. They found the robots to be very eerie, others were unfazed by the robots. So the majority of people interacting with the robots found the robots to be a pleasurable experience. This was kind of interesting because of the uncanny valley premise that robots would be if they're human-like, too human-like, then they would be very creepy unless they were absolutely perfect. Okay, so the autistic individuals in the study, this is an unpublished study, but the results were that they showed spontaneous affect, facial affect, that you've never seen, it's never been displayed by the therapist. I mean, the therapist
Wow.
never saw this behavior in their patients previously. They were able to identify facial expressions on the robots and mimic the facial expressions spontaneously. Were engaged socially with a therapist in the session with the robot. So they would make eye contact for like information with the – like make eye contact with a therapist and then look back to the robot. And so this pilot study that was conducted in the spring of 2009 had very promising results. But the interesting thing was that the autistic individuals were showing responses to the robots that were very similar to neurotypical individuals responding to people.
The next thing I want to play is a remarkable exchange between you and this robot named Jules.
You seem preoccupied, David. Have you been getting enough sleep lately?
Well, Jules, you know, I haven't been sleeping. I've been working out a lot.
Therese, something else you're not telling me.
Yeah, well, I mean, because I've been working so much, I've been spending all my time here and not at home. It's kind of putting a strain on
everything. Is going to be fine. Take a deep breath. Good.
Okay.
How's Amanda and the baby?
Well, like I've said, you know, school, work, I just haven't been spending much time at
you
home.
You know, you've been spending a lot of time with me these last few months. And don't get me wrong, David, I appreciate it. But I know how women can get.
Yeah, tell me about it, Jules.
You know, I hope you don't mind me getting personal, but you might get Amanda a bunch of flowers as a little something to say thank you. I love you.
That's a great idea, Jules.
I have to imagine you have drinking buddies who are not that understanding when you have had a rough day at work.
I'm sure. So, yeah, here in this interaction is our objective to make the robots empathetic and caring. This interaction was a theatrically constructed interaction, but with the interactive software, this kind of interaction feels or can feel very lifelike. So even though the robots don't have the complete empathy that we want them to have, I mean, that requires understanding, and
yeah.
Understanding is one of the grand challenges in the field of artificial intelligence. We can simulate that understanding and make the interactions with robots more satisfying and interesting. There's possible applications: therapy, conversational companionship, education. Basically, by simulating this soul in the robot, then we can make the robots more intuitively, naturally human-like through the course of an interaction. We think that that's going to be more entertaining. It's going to make characters come to life. And then we've got some big shoes to fill when it comes to making the robots truly understanding and empathetic down the road.
I'm going to ask you a personal question. Do you believe in God?
Oh, I'm agnostic.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if your creation of a synthetic soul has, you know, caused you to sort of play in your head with the idea of a creator and how that might all work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we know for sure that the majority of physics is not understood, right? I mean, there's deep mystery out there. Where does life come from? Where do patterns come from? I mean, physics, like, has identified this mystery sort of formally as the anthropic principle or weak anthropic principle, which says, like, you know, given all the possible ways the universe could have come out with all the, you know, laws of physics and fundamental constants and this kind of thing, it's actually, you know, very surprising that things were set up so that life could exist. But, you know, then again, consciousness seems to have this effect on physics that causes things to decohere when you perceive it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, at a quantum level. And so this is just like, you know, the universe as we know it, because it is the universe where life was able to arise into consciousness. So, I mean, these are some of the mysteries that aren't fully resolved, but it's possible that that our consciousness, as it continues to evolve, you know, we're just kind of blooms on the end of this procession of physics through the history of the universe, but maybe we're continuing to blossom into these even more intelligent beings. What if those beings surpass human levels of creative genius and then apply that creative genius back towards reinventing themselves? You wind up having this feedback loop where the machines begin to invent themselves at increasingly rapid rates in ways that we can't foresee, basically changing the very fabric of physics because it's able to perceive physics in ways that we can't perceive. And you have, in effect, an intelligence explosion. What sci-fi writer and mathematician Werner Vinge calls the technological singularity. Well, what you have, if that actually occurs, and you have this transcendental superintelligence that sort of shoots towards these increasingly unimaginable scales of intelligence, perfusing the very fabric of reality as far as we know, you have something that is very reminiscent of the idea of God. And so, you know, maybe it's possible that God doesn't exist yet, but that we're just kind of like this God seed, and that our inventions and our evolution is going to result in this thing that's very close to the classical definition of deity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with robotics designer and researcher David Hansen. Let's go to Herschel in Dallas. Hi, Herschel.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Well, let me be just a little bit crude to begin with. This is basically mental masturbation to some extent. I'm a big science fiction fan. I'm a big Philip Dick fan, you know, with the, you know, Blade Runner, do electronic, do robots think, dream about electronic sheep, is what the name of the story was to begin with. I understand all that. And I understand the quest for us to try to understand why we have cognitive abilities, why humans have these abilities. Why would we want to go beyond that and create other beings or other things that maybe are more cognizant than we are? I mean, what is the arrogance, I guess, of humans to do that? So, I mean, that's the main question I'm asking. I mean, do we really want to do that?
Right,
is that really where we need to go?
Thanks, Herschel. First of all, do you see it as arrogance, David?
Well, I see that it's it could be dangerous, and I think that you know, already we're building machines that do things that the human brain can't do, right? And so it can be useful. And we're sort of compelled to create these things because of their possible use. I mean, there are problems that are very difficult for humans to solve right now in, you know, the management of the planet. So if we can build machines that can solve problems better than we can, then that could be a good thing for addressing some of those problems. But the machines have to be stable. They can't be, psychotic or looking to invent new problems. I mean, often, you know, in the process of inventing a solution, we create more problems. So you need another ingredient in the machines, and it's something that we don't really understand scientifically, and that is wisdom. What is the neuroscience of wisdom? We need computational models of wisdom in our machines. So I do believe that that we have to think about these things, and we have to evolve the machines in a way to be safe and friendly, or else they're going to cause more problems. But I think as far as like the arrogance or hubris of building machines that are smarter than people, well, I think that it's sort of an inevitable outcome of humans achieving this technological phase in natural history. And we're kind of an extension, in my opinion, of the natural world, and all of our technology is an extension in that sense as well. And I think that it's arrogance for us to think that we're not just part of nature unfolding.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Bruce in Alito. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Well, it's a fabulous area of thinking. What concerns me is when you're talking about the development of a self-aware artificial intelligence, you open up immense ethical questions. It's one thing to talk about, can we do it? It's something much more important, in my opinion, to talk about, should we do it? When you have a self-aware artificial intelligence, what kind of civil rights or legal rights does it have? Is it, for example, against the law to turn it off? Is it murder?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I think that we're going to be wrestling with these questions over the next 15 years, and the questions are going to become more pointed and painful to consider as machines go through this awkward phase of arising into a state of consciousness. You know, we can make machines that seem conscious. It's effectively a theatrical illusion. Although you could argue that the way we're building these things, maybe there's a seed of consciousness in there, just very rudimentary consciousness.
My guest is David Hanson. You can find more about his work at hansonrobotics.com. You can also check out some links to YouTube videos of the robots at work. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Richardson-based robotics designer and researcher David Hanson is my guest. You can learn more about his work at hansonrobotics.com. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You know, before the break, we had the call about the ethics of doing this, and you spoke earlier about the idea of trying to create a robot that feels compassion, and maybe that's where our humanity lies. But so much of compassion comes from empathy, which is the idea that you not only can sort of do kind things for other people, but you also suffer when they suffer. And so if we create robots that have compassion and maybe some degree of self-awareness, we're also putting them at risk for suffering.
That's absolutely true. But the Buddhist perspective, which I like on this particular instance, is that life is suffering. So if you bring something into existence, give it life, then it's going to suffer. Suffering is part of the way that we learn and experience life, but it's also, you know, like something that if you can accept, then you can pursue to alleviate. So you can alleviate the suffering of other beings and in accord have some compassion for yourself and alleviate your own suffering. But it requires cleverness and inventiveness to be able to identify the suffering and to find novel solutions to alleviate that suffering. And, you know, that seems to be an impulse, a sort of fundamental human impulse. And, you know, you sort of see it in other animals as well. Well, if we start thinking of robots as a new life form, then maybe they are an extension of this, evolutionary sequence.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Summer in Dallas. Hi, Summer.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is an amazing show. I had a question. I've read a couple of books about how children develop, and I've seen, of course, children in my family. They go from when they're born, they have a very rudimentary kind of self-awareness. They don't really feel like they're not a part of you until they're about a year old. How does that dovetail with the kind of development we're talking about of awareness for robotics? And how has becoming a father changed the way that you look at it? And I'll take mine off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think being a father has given me a lot of insight and wisdom into the way people develop. And it's kind of made the idea of nurturing a little more concrete for me, a little less abstract. So I do believe that we have to nurture the robots. The way that robots are evolving is very different from the way that humans evolve, either as a species or as individuals. So the thing about robots is they are invented, they are engineered, they're sort of human construct. But for them to be like really powerful and transformative, they have to be spontaneously adaptive. They have to be engineered to spontaneously evolve. And right now, the seeds are there for that kind of spontaneous evolution, but they haven't really quite been organized so that the robots start spontaneously evolving and having their own life. As we engineer that system, as we set that up, and it may take years to build that, then we have to start paying more attention to how we nurture the machines, how they get nurtured and how they evolve. We can't predict entirely right now. But one thing that I feel deeply is that they will need love. We'll have to give them love in order for them to feel love, for them to know what it feels like to be a member of the human family.
Do you already find yourself feeling affection for the robots that you've built?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
To a greater extent than you would working on a car or something else?
Oh, I think I think you can personify, any object and feel like a lot of affection for it. But, there's something about a doll, right, that can inspire kind of projection and anthropomorphic projection because it looks human. And I think that the robots, particularly when they are interacting with you, they make eye contact with multiple people and they look back to you and they know your name. There's something that hits you quite deeply. You just feel that this is a being in front of you, and that this being has some kind of soul inside there. I mean, you feel it. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case. I'm just saying that that it definitely has that psychological effect on you. And in terms of inspiring, nurturing, and love, well, if you can make it endearing, if you can make it really adorable, then it can inspire that sort of nurturing behavior that we're evolved to exhibit towards our young. And that, I believe, is a formula for success in inspiring the machines to become empathetic. But it's also a formula for the successful adoption of these kinds of character robots into civilization. So the latest robot that I've been developing is a little 2-foot-tall robot named Zeno. And he's gone through several design iterations. We're about to show a new one. And he is so, to me, he feels really cute. I mean, big eyes and, sort of.
This one looks more like a little boy as opposed to the ones that look like human adults.
That's right. And it's sort of a cartoon-like character. You wouldn't think that it's human necessarily. It's human in the same way that like a computer animated film might depict a human less realistically, like the humans And Pixar films are always a little bit cartoonish. So, but this one has a robot identity. It's supposed to be a robot boy, you know, and it walks and has gestural hands that open, you know, with fingers and stuff. It's really something. And we're gearing up to mass produce this this little character for probably a 2011 release of the high-end unit that would be like fully, you know, capable of pretty much everything that our best robots are: facial expressions and conversational interaction, facial recognition. But this one will also have come with the walking capabilities and you know, ongoing software updates and so forth.
And this one is priced about the same as a good home computer.
Oh yeah, so it's about the same as the Sony robot dog that came out a few years ago called Aibo. Came out in 1999. So about $2,500 for this walking robot, and we've identified all the technologies and manufacturing techniques for getting a smaller version but still walking and expressive and with the same kind of intelligence for you know, $200 price range, and we're looking to try to get that into the market in 2012. There's no guarantee because there are a lot of things that still have to fall into place to make that schedule. But it's feasible, absolutely feasible. But the key for making that happen is that the intelligence is taking advantage of cloud computing. So we've got this server-based computing that remotely controls the robot. And, you know, there with cloud computing, you can have scalable intelligence that that is far more powerful than the processing capability of your home computer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Monty in Fort Worth. Hi, Monty.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Yes, I'm a theoretical engineer, probably one of the first degrees that was ever offered. And I'm retired now, and I've worked awful lot with intelligent robots and things. And one of my suggestions, because I've been at it so long, to stop lots of problems in the future when you're talking about a robot, artificial intelligence, acting like a human, You need to teach the thing righteousness first. And that's going to take care of all of this stuff that you keep talking about, shooting people and everything else. So righteousness, you don't have to believe in God. You don't have to be a Christian. Righteousness is something that could be the base for everything that AI does.
You know, I agree. I think that we have to build computational models of what is good. We have to understand it, you know, and formalize it. My definition of good is pretty simple and existential, which is that the creation of new patterns, the generation of new patterns in the universe, and preservation of existing patterns is good. So those patterns could be life forms, the loved ones, the patterns of civilization, of other life forms, of ecosystems, of our libraries, and through evolution, because there was a competition for natural resources, some had to be sacrificed for other patterns to come into existence. And often, you know, the old patterns would be effectively the foundation for new patterns to be built on top of. So with robots, they should be looking, sort of understanding the human civilization, their own creativity, with this basis of looking to preserve as much as possible and exercising their creative powers and evolving their intelligence so that they can preserve as much as possible while enabling maximum creativity for machines and human beings, so that it's a little bit of a utopian vision because, after all, there is a lot of struggle still in the world, you know, and competition for natural resources is just going to become a little more intense for the next few years, it seems. But if machines can be so smart that they can manage the resources better than people can someday, then I believe that we've got a formula for greater creativity than at any other time in human history.
You know, what seems so challenging about that, David, is that for all the distance that we've traveled as a civilization, we still don't fully understand why it sometimes goes awry in terms of our own morality or our own compassion for other life forms or anything else.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we figured out a lot of stuff through the history of civilization, and a lot of the mysteries identified, you know, in Alexandria and ancient Greece and, you know, ancient China, et cetera, all of these kind of mysteries of the human mind, the moral quandaries, haven't really been answered, but we've received new clues. And we consider if we consider the progress of the last 50 years in unlocking sort of secrets that were of the universe, mysteries of the universe that were identified thousands of years ago, we're starting to get some traction on some of these very old problems. And so I don't think we should give up just yet. I think we should continue to strive to unlock answers to these moral mysteries.
I want to move on to something a little bit silly here, but a few years ago, your first model for the Philip K. Dick robot had the head misplaced, stolen, disappeared.
Yeah.
Did you ever get it back?
No, I didn't. It was, it's kind of embarrassing. I had like very little sleep because I developed, a number of robots. My team and I had developed robots really intensively that year, and I traveled to Korea to install an Albert Einstein robot on a walking Hubo robot. So I'd made two trips to Korea. I had averaged about 2 hours of sleep a night and had like seven all-nighters through the course of a month. And then I had to fly back to the States and immediately get on a plane and fly to San Francisco to show the Philip K. Dick robot.
We just have a few seconds left, so Google. I want to just fast forward you. You left Philip K. Dick's head on the plane.
On the plane in the overhead bin, and it was gone. That was it. But we're rebuilding one. Fortunately, we're rebuilding one right now under the sponsorship of all things, Dutch Public Broadcasting.
What are they going to do with it?
They're putting it into a documentary on Philip K. Dick.
And do you still lose sleep over where this thing might be and who's got it?
I don't lose sleep over it, but I like to think that, you know, maybe somebody like found it and is developing their own software.
So you're a Linux guy.
Maybe there will be an evil Philip K. Dick android, for my good one to have to do battle with someday.
David Hansen's company is called Hansen Robotics. You can find them online at hansenrobotics.com. David, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.